And now, the DuPont Show of the Week.
A writer should be of as great probity as a priest of God. He is either honest or not, as a woman is chaste or not. And after one piece of dishonest writing, he is never the same again.
This hand wrote the words, describing the world as seen by these eyes. The eyes of Ernest Hemingway.
The Show of the Week is brought to you by DuPont Nylon, Orlon, and Dacron, fibers for fashion. DuPont Tellar Antifreeze and Summer Coolant. DuPont Lucite Wall Paint. Products of DuPont, makers of better things for better living through chemistry.
If you do your own painting, you know the troubles you have with ordinary wall paint. Messy, stirring and mixing, dripping, running. But now, DuPont has developed new Lucite wall paint. You don't mix or stir Lucite. It's always ready to use. Because Lucite is made thicker than ordinary paint, it really loads your brush or roller. You carry more paint to the wall every time, and it doesn't drip or run like regular paint. Lucite covers plaster, paint, wallboard, and wallpaper. Painting with Lucite is clean, easy, and quick. It's beauty without bother. Cleanup is quick and easy, too. Soap and water does it. And Lucite dries in just 30 minutes. Its beautiful flat finish is really washable. Lucite wall paint, made only by DuPont. Available in a wide range of modern colors. Try it. It's truly beauty without bother.
This is Chet Huntley. For the next hour, I shall conduct you in an exploration of the life of Ernest Hemingway, as prepared by NBC News. This program is based upon the results of their exhaustive inquiry. Hemingway emerges as one of the most talented, powerful, and important personalities of this century. He is the most widely read, serious author in the world today, and his work came directly out of the colorful and dangerous life he lived. He pursued experience with vigor and imagination. He gathered the raw material and processed it in his mind and heart. Then he applied to it the precision machinery of his style. The product was, perhaps, the best crafted export we've ever sent abroad to the world, the prose of Ernest Hemingway. His life and his work fed each other. They existed in harmony from his boyhood until his death, and because of this, there is a consistency which invests his work with the quality of genius. He was the figure in whose image nearly all his heroes were made. Nick Adams, the boy in his earliest stories, grew to become Frederick Henry in A Farewell to Arms. He was Jake Barnes in The Sun Also Rises, Robert Jordan in For Whom the Bell Tolls, and grew older to become Colonel Cantwell in Across the River and Into the Trees. In The Old Man and the Sea, the Cuban fisherman was of a different nationality, but he was still a generic Hemingway hero. He lived by the same code. Courage is the major virtue. The most important part of Hemingway's life was spent trying to write prose, as he said, without tricks and without cheating, with nothing that will go bad afterwards. No writer in our times has left a more vivid mark of his talent and personality on the world. Ernest was a half year older than the century, born in Oak Park, Illinois, the second of six children of Dr. Clarence Edmonds Hemingway, an obstetrician who loved and was skilled at hunting and fishing, and his wife, the former Grace Hall, who loved music.
I used to play cello. My mother kept me out of school for a whole year to study music, but I was absolutely without talent. Of course, that year I was out doing other things too.
¶¶
best part of the year for him was summer. The family went to northern Michigan, where at the age of 3, Ernest was given his own fishing rod, and at the age of 10, his first shotgun.
The first covey of partridges I ever shot was with my father. We came on them dusting and feeding in the sun beside the grist mill on Horton's Creek in Michigan. I was so excited with the whir of the wings that I missed both shots, while my father, shooting an old lever-action Winchester pump, killed 5 out of the covey. He was a beautiful shot, one of the fastest I've ever seen, but he was too nervous to be a great money shot.
These photographs are advanced one generation. They are of Hemingway and his own son. When Hemingway was 14, he asked for boxing lessons. In the first lesson, an ex-pro broke the boy's nose and inflicted what turned out to be a permanent injury to his left eye. But Ernie finished the course and became a first-rate amateur boxer. He thought and wrote often in terms of this sport, and his talent for it was exercised frequently in his life. In the fall of 1913, Ernie went to high school. He was an all-around boy in a classical Midwestern tradition. At Oak Park, he said, if you could play football, you had to play it. He did for 3 years, also managed the track team, competed in swimming, and was captain of the water basketball team. He was a member of the school orchestra for 3 years, played a lead in the senior class play, was editor and reporter for the school paper. He wrote the class prophecy and 24 short stories in his 17th year. He graduated that year at the height of World War I in Europe. It was 1917. President Wilson had coined the phrase, the world must be made safe for democracy, and the United States declared war on Germany. Ernest tried 12 times to enlist in the army. His father objected strongly, but he needn't have. The eye injury inflicted in the boxing lessons 3 years earlier caused Ernie's rejection. In September, he got a job as a cub reporter on the Kansas City Star. Short sentences he learned, short paragraphs, vigorous English. He went out chasing ambulances and squad cars and sent back his copy in the genesis of the Hemingway style.
On the Star, you are forced to learn to write a simple declarative sentence. Newspaper work will not harm a young writer if he gets out of it in time.
Hemingway did get out in time. He was watching the ticker as it clicked out that the American Field Service needed ambulance drivers. He volunteered and was assigned to the Red Cross. Less than a month later, he was in Paris, en route to Italy. He arrived during the shelling of Paris by Big Bertha, the most powerful cannon in the world, and went by taxi from the train to the area under bombardment. Danger was a magnet to him. 2 days later, he was off to Milan, near where the Italians, our allies, were fighting the Austrians, and took his place with the ambulance corps. From there, he went to the front.
Having a wonderful time. Had my baptism of fire my first day here when an entire munitions plant exploded. I go to the front tomorrow. Oh boy, glad I'm in it.
This exuberance reminds us that he was 18 years old at the time. He drove his ambulance alongside the sheer cliffs of the Italian Alps, along the hairpin curves. After 10 days, he was bored and itching for action. He persuaded a local commander to allow him to ride down to the trenches on a bicycle loaded with cigarettes, cigars, and candy. He did this for 6 days. On the 7th day, he was hit. A friend of Hemingway's wrote to Hemingway's father,
I've just been to see Ernest at the hospital here. You may be proud of your son's valor. With those in our section, he volunteered to go down to the Piave. It was when the Italians were pushing the Austrians back over the river. About midnight on the seventh day, a trench mortar shell fell within a few feet of Ernest. An Italian soldier was killed instantly, while another soldier lost both legs. A third Italian was wounded badly. After Ernest had regained consciousness, he put the latter on his back and carried him to the first aid dugout. He says he doesn't remember how he got there. Ernest was sent to Milan to the Red Cross Hospital. Here he's being showered with attentions by American nurses.
Several years later, Hemingway told a friend of his that he had been in love with a nurse who had left him, hurting him deeply. The physical wounds he had sustained, plus the loss of this woman, left bad scars. It was 10 years before he was able to write about the war. When he did, he wrote very specifically from his own experiences. Many critics regard the book as the finest modern novel America has produced, A Farewell to Arms.
During the time I was writing the first draft, my second son, Patrick, was delivered in Kansas City by cesarean section. And while I was rewriting, my father killed himself in Oak Park, Illinois. I remember all these things happening and all the places we lived in, and the fine times and the bad times we had in that year. But much more vividly, I remember living in the book and making up what happened in it each day. Making the country and the people and the things that happened, I was happier than I had ever been before. Each day I read the book through from the beginning to the point where I went on writing, and each day I stopped when I was still going good and when I knew what would happen next. The fact that the book was a tragic one did not make me unhappy, since I believed that life was a tragedy. I knew it can only have one end. But finding you were able to make something up, to create truly enough so that it made you happy to read it, and to do this every day you worked, was something that gave me greater pleasure than any I had ever known. Beside it, nothing else mattered.
He had learned, and he wrote in A Farewell to Arms, "The world breaks everyone, and afterwards many are strong at the broken places." Thus, from his experience through a period of gestation, during which his brain distilled his experience, to putting his experience down on paper, our inquiry traces the course of his work and reveals that the raw material of life is wrought by this man into art.
This is only the beginning for this luxurious new carpet. There'll be lots more footsteps ahead, years and years of them. That's why this family chose a carpet with pile of 100% DuPont 501 carpet nylon. They know that nylon is the strongest, toughest, longest-wearing fiber ever used in carpets. In a recent test, the number of feet that walked on carpeting of DuPont 501 nylon was recorded on an electronic meter. Back and forth, up and down, yet the carpet looked fresh, lively, and beautiful, even after the beating from thousands of pairs of busy feet. Carpets of DuPont 501 nylon look so beautiful after cleaning. The luscious textures resist shedding and fuzzing. So if you want the best in carpets, look for the finest in fibers. DuPont 501 carpet nylon. And look for the master's touch of a leading carpet maker, like Firth and its interior of DuPont 501 carpet nylon. Double assurance of years and years of performance and wear.
When Hemingway was released from the hospital, he did the sort of thing which had become a bold figure in the pattern of his life. He put the most powerful stress he could devise upon the part of him he feared might not be able to take the strain. With the scars of his wound still angry and the pain of his experience still alive in his memory, free to go home, free to go anywhere, he chose to enlist in the Italian infantry. He served with it until the armistice and returned to Oak Park with the Medal of Valor. A friend who knew him then later said he came back figuratively as well as literally shot to pieces. He seemed to have a tremendous need to express the things he had felt and seen. Hemingway did indeed give evidence of being troubled in deep and subtle ways. He needed to get away to nature, and he did, to the Michigan woods he had loved as a boy. To keep track of him chronologically, he was still in his 19th year. And for the first time, his life and his work coincide, and he becomes one of his own heroes, the boy the world knows as Nick Adams. The story is Big Two-Hearted River. It tells how Nick, deeply ill in spirit, takes solace from the peace of his solitary camp and the clean pleasure of fishing. The story is put together with the fragility, strength, and perfection of an egg. Nick's sensibilities are so delicately balanced that he dare not make an unpremeditated move lest he jar his mind into a breakdown. Gradually, the peace and harmony of the woods and the therapy of preparing his camp soothe Nick.
Inside the tent, the light came through the brown canvas. It smelled pleasantly of canvas. Already there was something mysterious and homelike. Nick was happy as he crawled inside the tent. He had not been unhappy all day. There had been this to do. Now it was done. He had made his camp. He was settled. Nothing could touch him. It was a good place to camp. He was there in the good place. He was in his home where he had made it.
In 1920, Hemingway met Hadley Richardson and became a reporter on the Toronto Star. Within 2 years, he had convinced the editors of the Star that they needed a roving reporter to cover Europe. He had almost complete freedom of movement and choice of material. There was no better job in the world for him just then. He married Hadley, and they were off to Paris. Hiring Hemingway turned out to be a good move on the part of the Star. The 22-year-old foreign correspondent cabled back sharp, funny, informative, always vigorous pieces.
Paris in the winter is rainy, cold, beautiful, and cheap. It is also noisy, jostly, crowded, and cheap. In some parts, it is lonely, austere, gripping, and cheap. Two of us are living at a comfortable hotel in the Rue Jacob. It is just back of the Academy of the Beaux-Arts and a few minutes' walk from the Tuileries. Our room costs 12 francs a day for two. It is clean, light, well-heated. There's hot and cold running water in a bathroom on the same floor. That makes a cost for rent of $30 a month. At the present rate of exchange, on an income of $1,000 a year, one can live comfortably and enjoyably in Paris. Our landlord described it as a third-floor apartment. I was taking a very romantic view of it. Our landlord would probably refer to a villa on the extreme top of Mount Vesuvius as an ideal location, well-heated and reached by a pleasant climb, only 28 minutes from the heart of Naples. The scum of Greenwich Village, New York, has been skimmed off and deposited in large ladles full on that section of Paris adjacent to the Café Rotonde, and made the Rotonde the leading Latin Quarter showplace for tourists in search of atmosphere. It is a strange acting and strange-looking breed that crowd the tables of the Café Rotonde. They have all striven so hard for a careless individuality of clothing that they have achieved a sort of uniformity of eccentricity.
He learned to love Paris. It became a city that was home to him as much as any in the world. He learned about painting and met Monet, Braque, Picasso. He met James Joyce. They did a certain amount of drinking together. The author of Ulysses was a small, thin, unathletic man with very bad eyes. When in the course of their drinking he ran into any sort of belligerence, he would jump behind his powerful friend and shout, "Deal with him, Hemingway, deal with him."
Joyce was writing Ulysses. The influence of his work was what changed everything and made it possible for us to break away from the restrictions.
He was introduced by a letter from Sherwood Anderson to the group which gathered around the formidable and brilliant Gertrude Stein. Later, Hemingway wrote to Anderson,
"Gertrude Stein and me are just like brothers, and we see a lot of her.
I remember very well the impression I had of Hemingway that first afternoon. He was an extraordinarily good-looking young man, 23 years old, with passionately interested rather than interesting eyes. We spent the evening. and he and Gertrude Stein went over all the writing he had done up to that time. Gertrude Stein rather liked the poems, but the novel she found wanting. There was a great deal of description in this, she said, and not particularly good description. Begin again and concentrate. What a book would be the real story of Ernest Hemingway. Not these he writes, but the confessions of the real Ernest Hemingway. For some years after this, Gertrude Stein and Hemingway did not meet. And then he was back in Paris, telling a number of people how much he wanted to see her. They sat and talked a long time. Finally, she said, Hemingway, after all, you are 90% Rotarian. Can't you, he said, make it 80%? No, she said regretfully, I can't. However, Gertrude Stein always says, yes, I know, but I have a weakness for Hemingway.
Years later, Hemingway replied.
Miss Stein wrote at some length and with considerable inaccuracy about her influence on my work. It was necessary for her to do this after she learned to write dialogue from a book called The Sun Also Rises. I was very fond of her and thought it was splendid she had learned to write conversations. It was no new thing to me to learn from everyone I could, living or dead, and I had no idea it would affect Gertrude Stein so violently. Here it is simpler and better to thank Gertrude for everything I learned from her and to say how fond I was of her.
F. Scott Fitzgerald, the Galahad of American novelists, was in Paris at the time. He was handsome, witty, talented, and successful. He drew the celebrated and the beautiful toward him without effort. He spent his time, his money, and his substance prodigally. Hemingway, his friend, watched without indulgence. The responsibility of talent was work. In a letter to Fitzgerald, Hemingway was harsh.
You put so much damn value on youth. It seems to me you confuse growing up with growing old. Forget your personal tragedy. When you get the damn hurt, use it. Don't cheat with it. You see, Bo, you're not a tragic character. Neither am I. All we are is writers, and what we should do is write. You need discipline in your work. You're a rummy, but you're no more of a rummy than Joyce is, and most good writers are. You're twice as good now as you were at the time you think you were so marvelous. All you need to do is write truly and not care about what the fate of it is.
Using Paris as his base, Hemingway roved Europe for the Toronto Star, eye alert and wit at the ready. At 23, he was a journalist of sharpened discernment with a faculty for seeing through sham and a gift for expressing it so that it crackled.
Mussolini is the biggest bluff in Europe. Get hold of a good photograph of Signor Mussolini sometime and study it. You will see the weakness in his mouth which forces him to scowl, that famous Mussolini scowl that is imitated by every 19-year-old fascisto in Italy. Study his genius for clothing small ideas in big words. And then look at his black shirt and his white spats. There is something wrong, even histrionically, with a man who wears white spats with a black shirt.
With the same sardonic perception, the young reporter continued to dispatch his impressions of Europe's political verities.
Queen Marie of Romania, who is a first-rate bridge player, a second-rate poetess, and a very high-grade puller of European political strings, and who uses more makeup than all the rest of the European royal families combined, is making every effort to form such European alliances that the coming disintegration of Romania will be stopped.
His growing sophistication included a knowledge of the cities as well as the people. He was in Berlin at 24 when he wrote,
Berlin is a vulgar, ugly, slovenly, dissipated city. After the war, it plunged into an orgy that the Germans called the Death Dance. There is nothing attractive or gay about the nightlife of Berlin. It is altogether revolting. Cocaine peddlers get short shrift from the Paris police, but in Berlin, they sell their wares openly all over the city. In some cafes, cocaine is served at the tables by the waiters.
There is no nightclub in Berlin that is not disgusting, heavy, dull, and hopeless. If anyone has any doubt that the Germans lost the war and realized that they lost it, all they need would be a session of After Midnight Berlin.
Lincoln Steffens, who met Hemingway at a political conference in Geneva in 1922, wrote about him at the time in his autobiography.
Hemingway was the surest future over there. Walking along the street with him, he would go boxing in the air, fishing, bull baiting, all the motions. In Paris, where they approve all eccentricities, nobody noticed except a smile with this big, handsome boy squaring off to phantom fight you. He was gay, he was sentimental, but he was always at work. Like Sinclair Lewis, like my little boy Pete, he was forever playing what he was writing. And he was straight, hard-boiled, honest, too.
By August 1923, Hemingway had his first book ready for publication. 3 stories and 10 poems. Later, these stories, with revisions, became the nucleus of the Nick Adams stories. His serious writing made him no money, and Hadley was about to have a baby. They decided they owed their child stability, so they returned to Toronto and to a regular weekly salary. This was in August. In October, John Hemingway was born, and by December, his 24-year-old father had reported enough concerts and one-alarm fires to last the rest of his life. The Hemingway family was off for Europe again, and this time to be supported not by a correspondent, but by a writer.
Here's a happy couple who picked the easy way to beautify their home with DuPont Lusa. With ordinary wall paint, it wasn't easy. Messy stirring and mixing, running, dripping. But now, DuPont Lucite wall paint is on the scene. Painting is clean, easy, and quick. You don't mix or stir Lucite. And because Lucite is made thick, you really load your roller or brush. And it doesn't drip or run like regular paint. You carry more paint to the wall. That makes Lucite fast. Lucite covers wallpaper, wallboard, plaster, and paint. Put it on heavy as needed for a quick and easy one-coat job. It won't run down like regular paint. Cleanup is quick and easy, too, with soap and water. Lucite dries in half an hour to a durable, flat finish. Colors stay bright and fresh after many washes. Lucite wall paint for beauty without bother. Made only by DuPont.
You are watching The Life of Ernest Hemingway. We'll return in a moment.
Research. Research is man's ingenuity and skill, an insight into the truths of science. The pioneering spirit of research is behind every invention, every discovery, every advance ever made. Research is the Wright Brothers' airplane, Alexander Graham Bell's telephone, and Daguerre's photography. At DuPont, research created the comfort and convenience of nylon and other man-made fibers, synthetic rubber, moisture-proof cellophane, and plastics. Research is the future, your future and your children's future. Research is the heart and pulse of a company like DuPont. Research that goes on continuously, day in, day out, to bring you better things for better living through chemistry.
The hero of The Sun Also Rises, Jake Barnes, has much to identify him with Hemingway. He is a writer living in Paris in the 20s. He was a Midwestern American who fought the Austrians on the Italian front. And he spent a good deal of his time drinking in cafes, fishing, or watching bullfights. The novel is developed against backgrounds simply described, but with such accuracy, they become a part of experience. The dialogue flows so easily that the reader often feels, I could have written this book. But it's put together with the precision of a watch, and every part meshes perfectly, all driven by a mainspring of inevitability.
The Sun Also Rises, I started in Valencia on my 25th birthday. Everybody my age had written a novel, and I was still having trouble with a paragraph. I wrote all through the Feria, went on to Madrid, and wrote there. It finally got too hot, and we went to Hyundai. I worked very well there, and then we went up to Paris and finished the first draft in the apartment over the sawmill. 6 weeks from the day I started.
The climax of The Sun Also Rises takes place during the festival of San Fermin in Pamplona, where by tradition the bulls are run through the streets of the town. In 1923, Hemingway covered this event for the Toronto Star.
In Pamplona, high up in the hills of Navarre, is held each year the World Series of Bullfighting. All the carnivals I had ever seen paled in comparison. All night long, the wild music kept up in the street below. Men, blue-shirted, bareheaded, came whirling and floating in a wild, fantastic dance down the street behind the rolling drums and shrill pipes. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. From far away, there was a dull report. "They're off," everybody shouted. "What is it?" I asked the man next to me, who was leaning far out over the concrete rail. "The bulls." They came in sight. 8 bulls galloping along, full tilt, heavy set, black, glistening, sinister, their horns bare, tossing their heads. They ran in a solid mass. And ahead of them, sprinted, bore, ran, and bolted the rear guard of men and boys at Pumpkin. Going on each year since a couple of hundred years before Columbus had his historic interview with Queen Isabella in the camp outside of Granada.
The spectacle of the bullfight affected Hemingway so deeply, he was to become one of the world's authorities on the subject. Death in the Afternoon, his book on bullfighting, is the definitive work in the English language. But here are some excerpts from his dispatches to the Toronto Star. The films of Hemingway were taken in 1959. But the words are from his first written account of the first bullfight he ever saw.
In the front rank walked the 3 espadas or toreros who have charge of the killing of the 6 bulls of the afternoon. Just behind them, and after your first bullfight, you do not look at their costumes but their faces, march the teams or cuadrillas. The bullfighters march across the sand. They march with easy, professional strides, swinging along with the grace and slight slouch of the professional athlete. The big gate was shut and bolted. There was no more entrance. The ring was complete. The crowd had been shouting and yelling. Now it was dead silent. For speed, strength, and viciousness. Bullfighting is an exceedingly dangerous occupation. In 16 fights I saw, there were only 2 in which there was no one badly hurt. I'm not going to apologize for bullfighting. It is a survival of the days of the Roman Colosseum, but it does need some explanation. Bullfighting is not a sport. It was never supposed to be. It is a tragedy, a very great tragedy. The tragedy is the death of the bull. It is played in 3 definite taps. First, the entry of the bull when the picadors receive the shock of his attack and attempt to protect their horses with their lances. The second act is the planting of the banderillas, 3-foot gaily colored darts with official fawn at the end. The banderillero walks out into the arena alone with the bull. The bull charges, and the bandoliero rises to his toes, bends in a curve forward, and just as the bull is about to hit him, drops the darts into the bull's hump just back of his horns. The last act is the death. directly from the front by the matador. Before killing him, however, he must first do a series of passes with a muleta, a piece of red cloth he carries about the size of a large napkin. With the muleta, the torero must show his complete mastery of the bull, must make the bull miss him again and again by inches before he is allowed to kill him. The bull in full charge and kill him with a sword thrust between the shoulders, just back of the neck, and between the horns. No, not. It is him or the bull. There are no drawn battles in bull.
From 1923 on, Spain was the foreign country in which Hemingway felt most at home. During the 13 years after that first fair at Pamplona, he spent much time following the bullfights, fishing for trout in the Pyrenees, wandering the bare and somber landscapes of the Guadarrama Mountains, and writing in the compatible atmosphere of Spain. The Sun Also Rises, Death in the Afternoon, and some of his best short stories were written there. When the Spanish Civil War began in 1936, Hemingway found himself a deeply committed anti-communist partisan on the loyalist side. He gave $40,000 of his own money to buy ambulances and established headquarters at the Florida Hotel in Madrid, which was under frequent bombardment. He went out to cover the most active combat areas for the North American newspaper Alliance. His salary of $500 a week was donated to the loyalists. Hemingway despised fascism from his first glimpse of it when he had interviewed Mussolini in 1923. He conceived a rabid hatred for it in its Italian and German varieties when he saw the armies and air forces of those two countries testing their war machines on the Spaniards, to whom he was a most loyal friend.
You grow accustomed to war, but no one becomes accustomed to murder. Murder on a large scale we saw every day for 19 days. The totalitarian fascist states believe in a totalitarian war. That put simply means whenever they are beaten by armed forces, they take their revenge on unarmed civilians. If I described it, it might make you hate. But we do not want hate. We want a reasoned understanding of the criminality of fascism and how it should be opposed. We must realize that these murders are the gestures of a bully. There is only one way to quell a bully, and that is to thrash him. And the bully of fascism is being beaten now in Spain as Napoleon was beaten in the same peninsula 130 years ago.
Hemingway had a remarkable vision of the probable course of the events of the next decade and expressed it with clarity. But not enough people listened.
Have you read Hitler's speech? If you have, you know there's going to be a war. One thing can delay it. If Hitler loses confidence in his allies. The way to avoid the world war is to end it where it has begun. In Spain, by smashing world fascism's weakest link, the beatable Italian military machine. If Italy could be beaten in Spain, as Napoleon was beaten there, the Berlin-Rome-Tokyo axis would be broken before it ever had a chance to make the war it threatens.
Those were excerpts from articles written from the Florida Hotel, the early part of 1938. It was also in the Florida Hotel that Hemingway wrote his only play, The Fifth Column. It was an effort to make the true facts of the war in Spain alive to the rest of the world.
Each day we were shelled. And while I was writing the play, the Hotel Florida, where we lived and worked, was struck by more than 30 high-explosive shells.
So if it is not a good play, perhaps that is what is the matter with it. If it is a good play, perhaps those 30-some shells helped write it.
Hemingway was seldom out of the range of enemy guns and aircraft. He was a scholar on the subject of war, and he increased his knowledge the hard way.
When a man goes to seek the truth in war, he may find death instead. But if 12 go and only 2 come back, the truth they bring will be the truth, and not the garbled hearsay that will pass as history.
Out of his admiration and deep affection for the Spanish people, and his hatred for fascism, and out of his knowledge of the war and the lives of its participants, Hemingway wrote a superb novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls. In this book, the hero, Robert Jordan, again a hero with many points of identification with Hemingway, feels about the war as Hemingway did. At the end of the novel, Jordan, wounded and resigned to death, aims his automatic rifle toward the Italian invaders preparing to fire.
If we win here, we will win everywhere. The world is a fine place, worth the fighting for, and I hate very much to leave it. Then he looked up at the sky, with big white clouds in it. He touched the palm of his hand against the pine needles where he lay, and he touched the bark of the pine trunk that he lay behind. And then he rested as easily as he could, with his two elbows on the pine needles and the muzzle of the submachine gun resting against the trunk of the pine tree.
In this book, Hemingway's superlative skill as a writer is evident on every page. His dialogue is so true that in English he makes the rhythms of Spanish absolutely natural. Every character is a real and solid person, fulfilling a genuine function in a real and solid world. But the most important thing about this book is something else. It is the first time Hemingway, or his hero, follows a cause bigger than the desire for experience. The hero has become a fighter for people weaker than himself. The title of the book comes from one of the most perfect passages in literature. It's by John Donne. We quote it in part. No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, part of the main. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind. And therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Now you can end the last-minute rush for antifreeze. End the inconvenience and expense of draining out old antifreeze and putting in a full new supply each fall. Now, from DuPont, comes Tellar, the antifreeze that outlasts your car. Any car, old or new, Tellar is an ideal summer coolant, too. It keeps your car's cooling system new car clean, helps prevent overheating. And here is Dr. Frank Keenan, who headed the DuPont research team that developed Tellar antifreeze and summer coolant.
Tellar ends the annual rush for antifreeze because you can leave Tellar in your car's cooling system indefinitely and safely. Just replace small, normal losses. You see, there's a real danger that damaging rust can form if other antifreezes are left in your cooling system too long. But DuPont Tellar contains a new patented rust inhibitor that prevents this destructive rust and corrosion from forming. And DuPont certifies this protection. You see, Tellar has a built-in color check feature. As long as Tellar is red, you are getting proper protection against rust and corrosion. If Tellar ever changes from its normal red color to yellow, your dealer will replace the Tellar at no cost, except possibly for installation, for as long as you keep your car.
DuPont Tellar is installed just like any other antifreeze. You use the same amount. Your dealer installs it quickly and easily. And now Tellar has a new low price, only $3.95 per gallon. Protection down to 0 degrees costs only about a dollar more than ordinary antifreeze, even less for compact cars.
And because Tellar outlasts your car, you actually save money after the first year. Get Tellar antifreeze and summer coolant. It's made by DuPont.
In 1933, Hemingway made an extended safari into Africa and emerged with some fine heads and skins of animals. But the most important trophies were the books about his experiences on the safari, The Green Hills of Africa, and two of the best short stories in American literature, The Short Happy Life of Francis Macomber and The Snows of Kilimanjaro. The hunting of big game was one of Hemingway's greatest pleasures. He was proud of the accuracy of his shooting, the endurance which made it possible for him to hike the steepest or the rockiest or the muddiest terrains from sunrise to dark. And more than anything else, his nervelessness in the face of danger. Nature provided facilities for these talents with great abundance in Africa. The plains were alive with game. Hunting gave point and zest to Hemingway's life. It provided a first-hand, face-to-face opportunity to live by the code.
Kilimanjaro is a snow-covered mountain, 19,710 feet high, and is said to be the highest mountain in Africa. Its western summit is called the Masai Ngai, the House of God. Close to the western summit, there is the dried and frozen carcass of a leopard. No one has explained what the leopard was doing at that altitude.
That is the beginning of The Snows of Kilimanjaro. Discipline is the spine of a writer's life. This story of a writer's default was written at a time when Hemingway was deeply concerned over his own breaches of work discipline. The leopard might represent a try for immortality. He got high enough to reach the eternal snow, and in that icy place he will never spoil. Harry, the writer, below on the plane, dying of the gangrene of his rotting leg, sold out. He never made his bid for immortality.
A writer should be of as great probity as a priest of God. He is either honest or not, as a woman is chaste or not. And after one piece of dishonest writing, he is never the same again.
World War II came, when and how Hemingway had predicted some years earlier it would, and he was in it. Free-swinging, commanding, heavily bearded, and paternal. He was only 42, but he was already Papa. He had been for some time. He was by then well recognized as one of the world's great authors, and also something of an authority on war.
I have seen much war in my lifetime, and I hate it profoundly. There are worse things than war, and all of them come with defeat. The more you hate war, the more you know that once you are forced into it, for whatever reason it may be, you have to win it. You have to win it and get rid of the people that made it and see that this time, it may never come to us again.
He got himself accredited to the Royal Air Force as a correspondent. He flew a number of missions, and then he was attached in rapid succession to the Third Army, an American pursuit squadron in France, and the 4th Infantry Division, where he shared the lives of the GIs of the 22nd Infantry Regiment. This regiment was in a constant series of battles, climaxed by one in Hürtgen Forest that lasted nearly 3 weeks. 2 out of every 3 men were casualties. Hemingway stayed with the regiment during this entire action. But the war really became his kind of war when he commandeered a jeep and, shooting ahead of the entire Allied army, established contact with French guerrilla fighters. When an armored column started toward Paris, Hemingway, by his knowledge of military strategy, knew they would encounter German resistance on the way. So he went through the back roads with a force of 200 men and was fighting at the Arc de Triomphe while the assembled armies were still on the outskirts of Paris. Venice is the scene of Hemingway's next book. From all he knew of the Second World War, and from a composite of all his experience, came Across the River and Into the Trees.
The hero is a badly beat-up professional soldier of 50 years who, like Hemingway, had fought to defend Venice from the Austrians at Posalta when he was 19. When he was Nick Adams, just become Lieutenant Frederick Henry. Now he is Colonel Cantwell on leave in Venice.
We are coming into my town. It is my city because I fought for it when I was a boy. And now that I am a half a hundred years old, they know I fought for it. And I am a part owner. And they treat me well.
The Colonel is closer to Hemingway than any of his other heroes, down to details, down to the loss of his right kneecap at Posalta. He is a unique combination of toughness and tenderness, a man in love with a girl 30 years younger than he. In spite of his richly sensual descriptions of Venice, the food, the wines, and the love of his beautiful and aristocratic girl, this is the least successful book Hemingway wrote. Critics jumped all over it. The book can only distress anyone who admires Hemingway. Another said, it is not only Hemingway's worst novel, it is a synthesis of everything that is bad in his previous work. It throws a doubtful light on the future. Nothing happens, they said.
Sure, they can say anything about nothing happening and across the river. But all that happens is the breakthrough in Normandy, the taking of Paris, and the destruction of the 22nd Infantry Regiment in Hurtgen Forest, plus a man who loves a girl and dies. Only it is all done with three cushion shots. Writing, I move through arithmetic, through plain geometry and algebra, and now I'm in calculus. If they don't understand that, to hell with them.
Hemingway Angry was a great competitor. The critics surely had hurt him, although he wouldn't admit it, and he was going to defend himself the way he had to.
It is sort of fun to be 50 and feel you're going to defend the title again. I won it in the 20s and defended it in the 30s and 40s. I don't mind at all defending it in the 50s.
He defended his title by writing another novel. This time, the critics said, The Old Man and the Sea is destined to become a classic in its time. Another said, When the taut line cut the old man's hands and the sun pounded on his skull, my hands hurt and my head ached. They went on to say, The book is as faultless as any short novel of our times. It needs no interpretation and stands as it is, beautiful and glorious with the majesty of man. The book won him both the Nobel and Pulitzer Prizes. He was champ again.
Who the hell wants fame over a weekend? All I want is to write well.
He had been living for some years in Cuba at Finca Viga, Lookout Farm, an estate of 15 acres with gardens, tennis courts, and a swimming pool. An easygoing establishment in spite of its staff of more than a half dozen servants. Here is the living legend. The handsome head photographed with the world's celebrities. The sportsman we have seen standing by the giant fish, the fallen lion. Here is the expert, skier, soldier, the man who never got past high school, but spoke French, Spanish, and Italian fluently. Here is a naturalist, a navigator, an authority on bullfighting and on boxing. Here is a man who sought the most dangerous conditions the world could offer, but who could be shaken by the sight of a black cat, and who hated to travel on Friday. This unique man, this aggregate of powerful appetites, justified his existence on Earth when he climbed these stairs and went through this door. For this is where he sculpted with words the living human beings in a solid, real, and tangible world. This is where he was a creator.
When I am working on a book or a story, I write every morning as soon after first light as possible. There is no one to disturb you, and it is cool or cold, and you come to your work and warm as you write. You write until you come to a place where you still have your juice and know what will happen next, and you stop and try to live through until the next day when you hit it again. You have started at 6 in the morning, say, and may go on until noon or maybe through before that. When you stop, you are as empty and at the same time never empty, but filling. As when you have made love to someone you love. The hardest thing in the world to do is to write straight, honest prose on human beings. First, you have to know the subject, and you have to learn how to write. Both take a lifetime to learn. I use the oldest words in the English language. I know the $10 words. But there are older and better words, which if you arrange them in proper combination, you make it stick. A writer can be compared to a well. There are as many kinds of wells as there are writers. The important thing is to have good water in the well. And it is better to take a regular amount out than to pump the well dry and wait for it to refill. The country that a novelist writes about is the country he knows. And the country that he knows is in his heart. Once writing has become your major vice and greatest pleasure, only death can stop it.
This program was produced by NBC News, which is solely responsible for its content.
This is Robert Lansing. Give the police lab a sliver of glass, and they can tell you what make car the suspect was driving, when he last had it washed, and what states he'd visited. Join the men at the 87th Precinct tomorrow night following The Price is Right here on NBC.
USO, wherever they go. Next week at this time, presenting the past and present of such people as...
I'm Jack Benny from Waukegan.
This is Joe E. Brown.
Harry Lillis Crosby here.
Hello, this is Marilyn Monroe.
This is Bob Hope.
I'm Danny Cave.
I'm Frances Langford.
I'm Merle Oberon.
I'm Dick Powell.
My name is Debbie Reynolds.
I'm Danny Thomas.
Hi, I'm Steve Lawrence.
And I'm Edie Gourmet.
And maybe starring you. If you ever saw a USO show any place in the world. And more, much more, next Sunday, when the DuPont Show of the Week presents USO, wherever they go.
The Show of the Week is brought to you by DuPont Nylon, Orlon, and Dacron, fibers for fashion. DuPont Tellar Antifreeze and Summer Coolant. DuPont Lucite Wall Paint. Products of DuPont. Makers of better things for better living through chemistry.
This has been an NBC Television Network presentation.
One doctor and two grave diggers add up to Thriller. Boris Karloff stars Monday at 10, 9 Central Time on NBC.